The next two sessions, tonight and next week, will be on American church history. For those of you who are taking the class for credit, you remember you are to have a paper on one aspect of church history, and that should be turned in next week. Particularly, we suggested a study of certain men to narrow down in one particular area. You should also, those of you who are taking it for credit, finish your reading of Cairns for the next time. Now, in order to cover our church history in the next two sessions, we're going to have to move even more rapidly than we have been doing. Tonight, we want to cover the colonial period, which goes from 1620 to 1789. And then we will cover the national era. We hope to make it into this period. And then finally, the modern era. And so we hope to make it about halfway tonight and then cover the next period the next week we meet. Now, if you get this in mind, you can, historically, you can break up our history in three different eras. The colonial period up to 1789, the national era, where we develop as a nation, and then from a church history point of view, from 1865 on, which we have sort of arbitrarily called the modern era. 1865 is picked because of the Civil War, and that is a good point in a new direction in many denominations, as well as in our nation as a whole. And we might do this to our chart. Theologically, if you understand three movements with the three periods, you'll understand what has happened to the American church as a whole. In the first period, the colonial period, the theological character is Calvinism. It begins as a very high, pure Calvinism, and by the end of the period has degenerated very seriously. In the next era, the national era, or the period from 1789 to 1865, the great stress is on growth, and there is a growth particularly in the Baptistic groups, the Methodist groups, the revivalist, but the theological character is Arminianism, not Calvinism. Calvinism has gone into a serious decline, and then there is the rise of Arminianism at this period of time. And then we would say the modern period, you degenerate into liberalism. And you can take the history of our major denominations, and you can see in virtually every denomination the growth of liberalism following Arminianism. It is significant that even the Roman Catholic Church has, of course, gone from Augustinianism into Arminianism, and then into, in our own day, liberalism. And the idea of a liberal Roman Catholic Church is very much with us today. So that by way of looking at outline of the American church history that we hope to pursue. Now, the first thing that we want to look at is the origin of the denominations. Today we have some 250 different denominations in America. And that is a unique feature of our American religious life. So where do they all come from? Well, when our study of European and English church history, we saw that there were four major traditions that arose in the Reformation. There was the Lutheran tradition, there was the Reformed tradition, there was the Anabaptist tradition, and then there was the English Reformed element, or Anglicanism. And so you basically had four major streams that were giving rise to different kinds of groups. Now, almost in any geographical location in Europe, there was only one kind. Since there were state churches, they only tolerated one kind in any one location. But in America, we're going to see, because we don't have a state religion, that we're going to have 250 varieties by the time we get finished. So the origin of denominationalism, we might as well start out with, if you're following a strict outline, Roman numeral 1, the colonial period, 1620 to 1789. And A would be the origin of denominations. And one under this, the planting of congregationalism. So we'll start with the congregationalist. The congregationalist, a congregationalist is a group, a very not well-defined group, but in the early part of our church history, you could talk about the congregationalist, and that's what they were. They were local churches, like this one, that were Calvinistic in theology, but not officially tied one to the other. And, of course, you all know that the Pilgrims came over on the Mayflower. And they came over for a couple of reasons. Somebody has said that the reason why people came to America was for three reasons. They came for religious reasons. They came for the gospel. They came for gold, or they came for glory. And usually they didn't find any gold or glory in America. So they came for religious reasons predominantly. The Pilgrims, when they left, they were discouraged in England because they couldn't fit into the state church. They migrated to Holland first, but they didn't fit in Holland. The language barrier was hard for them. And so they came across on 102 people, including 34 children. Two people died on the trip. Two were born. And they came to America to set up a colony. And the Pilgrims, as you know, were just a very small group. They came in 1620. They were from a poor class of people in England. They were uneducated. They were, for the most part, separatists from the state church. They favored the king. They settled in Plymouth, England. The Puritans, which come later than they come in another move somewhat later. Particularly in the year 1629 and 30, a great mass of people came. At one time, from 1630 to 1640, it was estimated that 20,000 of the cream of England came. Another 20,000 went to the islands, such as Barbados and the Indies. They were upper middle class. They were very educated. They were loyal to the state church, in a sense, but they wanted to purify it. And so the Pilgrims and the Puritans have a different stress. They come from a different social class in England, and they have a different idea of the church. The Pilgrim wanted to have a separate church. The Puritan left because the church was not pure enough for him. But he felt a real loyalty to Mother Church in England. The Pilgrims as a whole favored the church. The Puritans didn't. Favored the king. The Puritans did not favor the king. They felt that part of the problem was the king. So they came over, and eventually the two groups will merge. The Plymouth colony merges with the Salem and Boston colony, and they form Massachusetts in 1649. So the first group that you get coming over is the Congregationalist. Now, I must correct myself in one sense. I am thinking particularly of what we consider the northern part of America. And we must say that there was Catholic influence in America. I don't have any light now, do I? Anyway, we started with this. And we're talking about the colonial period, and we are tracing the various denominations that have come in at this time. So what we want to do is now look at this overhead, and you can see the various parties that have come in. The one thing that we did not really mention, and I don't plan to, is the Spanish colonization. It is obvious that there was a Catholic influence in America before there was this influence. The Roman Catholics were down in Florida, and they were, of course, down in the New Mexico area very early, earlier than what we're talking about here. But they did not really have lasting significance on the American process, and so I don't want to deal with that at this point. So all I want to do at this point is simply talk about the origin of the major denominations. Now, the first we talked about was Congregationalism coming into America. The Congregationalists are the ones that are in the brown on the chart. And so you can see the states in which the Congregationals came in. The Anglicans are in purple on the chart, and those are the main states in which the Anglicans came over. Now, the Anglicans, since Anglicanism was a state church in England, when the royal party wanted to start a colony on six of the colonies, they chartered Anglicanism to be the religion of the place. And so in these particular areas, there can only be Anglicans, and they would persecute anybody who wasn't an Anglican in these areas. So you get Anglicanism very quickly as the result of the fact that we were tied to England at that point. And this would be what we would call Episcopalianism in our language today. The third group that we want to mention as coming over at this point is the Baptist. Now, the Baptist, if you notice that little small mark right there in red, the Baptists, although they're the largest of our groups today, the Southern Baptists, the largest of our denomination, this will bear notice. Because one of the significant things in American church history is why, when you have this kind of a thing in our beginnings, with Anglicanism, Catholicism, the mixed groups, the Presbyterian, Quaker, Mennonite, Moravian, Lutheran, and the Congregationalist, why did the Baptist grow so rapidly? Of course, a Baptist might say because it's the truth or something. But we don't want to jump to anything that wild. As you know, the Baptists with Roger Williams, they came over and they were a separatist group. Also, Ann Hutchison, famous figures in American history. We don't have time to explore all them, but anyway, they came over at the same time that many of the Congregationalists and the Puritans did, and they settled in this area. They purchased land from the Indians. They were expelled from Massachusetts, and so they formed their own little colony, and they grew rapidly in the later periods. The fourth group is the Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholics, Maryland, is the predominant area in which Roman Catholicism, even today. Lord Baltimore, a convert to Catholicism, formerly named George Calvert, came over, and he wanted to create a refuge for English Catholics. And as you remember, since Anglicanism is the established church during most of the period in England, Catholics are being persecuted in England also. So they come over and they establish a colony for them. In almost all these cases, these groups were persecuted, except for the Anglicans. They were persecuted over in their home country, or else they tried to reform the church and they couldn't. So you get Roman Catholicism. The Presbyterians, they, of course, remember from 1640, were an attempt to purify the English church, only they were not really Puritans. They wanted to set up a new state church with Presbyterianism as its base. The early Presbyterians came with the migrations to New England. You're going to have a tremendous migration of the Scot-Irish Presbyterians from Northern Ireland. And they will come mainly due to a famine. And so many Presbyterians will come eventually and migrate all in this area that by the time of the American Revolution, one out of every three Americans will be a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian. And so they will be a tremendous force in the early part of the American church history. A sixth group that comes over is the Quaker group. The Quakers, their founder George Fox, they stress the inner light, waiting on God. The Bible was a secondary rule of faith. It was more a subjectivism. William Penn favored a refuge for the Quakers who were being persecuted in England. And so they came over and migrated into the area of Penn's Land, or Pennsylvania, as it became known. Penn's Land also was a refuge for the Moravians. You remember the Hussites that we studied? Well, the Hussites broke up into two groups, the Taborites and the Utraquists. They were being persecuted over there. So they came from Zinzendorf's estate, where they had been refugees, and they came to America. Some to Georgia, but most of them went to Penn's land, where they established Bethlehem and Nazareth. Good biblical names. If you wonder where Bethlehem steel and where they get their names from, people like that. Lutherans also came over very early. Swedes in the Delaware Valley. Some Lutherans in the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam. The Mennonites are another group that come over at this period of time. They are followers of a man named Menno's Simon, who was a converted Roman Catholic priest. He also his followers come to Penn's land, and they form Germantown. And then there are some other minor groups like the Dunkers and the Schwechtfelders. They come over at this point. So all that under origin of American denominationalism. One of the reasons why we have so many denominations in America is because we started that way. Everybody who couldn't get along where they're at came to America and set up house here. And so you had all kinds of groups here, and then when they came over here, they couldn't always get along with each other, and so they would form little groups of their own and separate it into various segments. We might also look at it in this regard. This looks at the origins of our denominations from another point of view. It looks at the origins of our denominations from where they came from. If you look at this somewhat complicated chart, from the British Isles up on the left, you get, first of all, from the English side, you get Catholics going to Maryland, you get Anglicans coming into the six colonies, you get Puritans going, of course, to Massachusetts, and you get also Connecticut Puritans, and you get Rhode Island Baptists. The Quakers to Pennsylvania. The Methodists will come later, but we have them on the chart there. And then on the other side of the British Isles, from Scotland, you get the, and from Ulster, you get the Presbyterians, mainly from the Scottish side. Since England became Anglican, well, Scotland, remember, adopted the Presbyterian confessions and became Presbyterian as a nation. And so there was a constant struggle between England and Scotland, since they were both under the same head. The Anglicans persecuted the Presbyterians, and so many of the Presbyterians came here. Scotland, however, stayed Presbyterian, in spite of all the efforts of the Anglicans to try to make it an Anglican country. They never were successful. On the continent, you've got the French, being a Catholic state, the people who were influenced by Protestantism became what was known as Huguenots. They were bitterly persecuted, so they came to America and merged with the Scotch-Irish and mainly went into the Presbyterian groups. From Germany and from Sweden, you get the Lutherans, and from Holland, you get the Mennonites, the Dutch Reform, and the Dutch Reform that turned into the Christian Reformed Church. So the different segments of where these people come from will form denominations. For example, if we take the Lutherans, if you get a German-speaking Lutheran and he comes over to this country, what's he going to do? Well, his tradition is Lutheranism. He speaks German. And so the tendency was, as these people came to America, they would settle in a little community and they would form their own group. For example, like the Missouri Synod Lutherans. And for a long period of time, they would remain a German-speaking Lutheran group. Or if you go to the Swedish people, where when Lutheranism becomes a state church, you'll get people who can't go with a state church of Lutheranism. So they'll come to America and they will form a free church. But they will be Swedish and speak Swedish language. And so they'll set up a church that has a reaction to Lutheranism, but it will be a national type church. And so a lot of our denominationalism has its origins, not necessarily in doctrinal conflicts that somebody broke off from somebody right off in America, but really different backgrounds of immigration and different traditions that they had grown up in, different languages, different governmental structures that they were born into that they had really not much to do with. Then I want to, all that was under A. B, now, the decline in New England theology. The Puritans, when they came over, they came with a very specific idea in mind. They wanted to set up a church state. Perry Miller of Harvard University has written a number of books on the Puritans. Some of his are pretty good. He has one that it's entitled An Errant into the Wilderness. They felt called of God to go into the wilderness and to establish a theocracy. But very early, the Puritans found that they had problems because of the people who came over. By 1643, believe it or not, and remember the Puritans started really, the Great Migration of the Puritans begins in 1629. By 1643, only 11% of the people held membership in the church. So there was a lot of people coming over. There were a lot of people coming over who weren't necessarily as religious as the main drive. So they came over and they didn't always they weren't always as religious. And the problem that arose very quickly was the problem of who was a church member. Now this was very crucial in their theology because their theology was still church and state tied together. Unless you were a church member, you couldn't vote. And so the question of who was a church member became a crucial issue. So if you wanted to vote and to have any part in your government, you had to be a member of the church. And so the question is, who is a member? Well, a person was a member of the organized church if he had been baptized. And so they baptized their infants. But people grew up very quickly, and then they had their children. And some of the people who grew up, who came over, the second and then the third generation, the second generation were not necessarily godly people. And the question came, should the third generation be baptized and be made members of the church? In other words, if you are a person who is a Christian and you baptize your infant, when your infant grows up to age 20, or 25 and has a child, and your son now has no real interest in the church, but he brings his child for baptism. Should he be baptized and be made a member of the church, even though he is living in a house which really is not committed to religious issues? Well, that was the issue that they worked on, and they came up with a halfway covenant, which was really a sellout. If you read Cairns, in which anybody who was baptized, regardless of their parents, was considered a member of the church. So they opened the door to virtually anybody being a member of the church, and this diluted the character, really, of the Puritan church. The Puritans did a lot of good things, though. They stressed education. And they did something that was very unique. In 1647, they passed the Old Satan Deluder Act, which provided that every area, every township that had over 50 families had to provide for free public education. This is something which is absolutely unique in the world. Even today, I was talking to a friend of mine who is in Germany. He said that only 8% of the German children go through high school. They are shunted off into trade schools. If a person does not have academic ability, he is shunted off by no later than 10th grade. So the Americans, though, have always had since this foundation of the Puritans, have always had some kind of a feeling that everybody ought to be as educated as possible. And so we've tried to have not only high school for everybody, but almost college for everybody. And it has certain limitations, but also has certain benefits. We have a higher educational level as a whole for the nation than the rest of the world as a whole. Now, some other nations that specialize in in a particular education for an elite can sometimes do better. But the Puritans can be thanked for their stress on higher education. As you know, they formed Harvard in 1636, the first college in America. The goal of Harvard was to train ministers, so that when the ministers that came over with the Puritans would be in the dust, that they would have other ministers who would be godly men who would be raised up to fill the gap. Unfortunately, Harvard didn't last very long as far as an Orthodox school. By 1701, Harvard was founded in 1636. By 1701, Yale was founded to train clergy because of the growing liberalism at Harvard already. And by 1801, Henry Ware was appointed Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard, and he was a Unitarian. So it went from 1636 to 1801, 170 years, and a school that was founded to train men to preach the gospel is now a Unitarian school. And of course, as you know, today Harvard is still a Unitarian school in its divinity school. As far as its college, it's very much secularized, of course. Interestingly enough, Yale, which in 1701 was founded to train clergy, the Great Awakening, under Whitfield, refused to have Whitfield preach there because they had gone liberal. And so the history is going to be one thing that we're going to learn is that schools don't stay Orthodox very long. Princeton Seminary, Princeton College was formed in the 1720s. Again, a stress for higher education. And almost all of the early schools were formed for a religious motivation in America. King's College, which becomes Columbia, was formed to train Indians. The College of Philadelphia grew out of a tabernacle that was erected for Whitfield's Crusades. It became an academy in 1751. It was one of the first non-denominational schools. College of Rhode Island was Baptist, became Brown University. Moore's College, Indian Charity School, became Dartmouth College. There was, in early church history, an attempt to evangelize the Indians. John Eliot, called the Apostle to the Indians. He went out and worked with the Indians, translated the Bible into Algonquin, wrote a catechism. Thousands of Indians were converted and began living in various villages and were Christianized. But then a war came along, King Philip's War, which sort of destroyed a lot of this work. So you have this rise of education, an attempt to reach the Indian, and this was one of the great stresses that we have from the Puritans. Then we want to look at the first Great Awakening. The Great Awakening, we have a number of awakenings in America, and we want to look at it in this regard. If you look at the history of revivalism in America, one of the features of America which differs from periods that we've seen in the continent is that America has been punctuated by periodic awakenings. And this is, I think, a significant thing in American church history. The colonial period goes into a period of decline. Then there is a great awakening from 1720 to 1740. Then, right after the war, there will be a second great awakening. Then there will be the revivals under Finney. There will be the layman's prayer revival. And then there will be the period of the great evangelists, such as Billy Sunday, Bob Jones, Rhoda Haver, etc. And then the era of Billy Graham. So we are going to have the history of revivalism in America, which will become a feature of American church life. Periodically, there will be an attempt, sometimes it looks like a human attempt, but we would say that there are periodic times of refreshment that the Lord gives, otherwise the church would be in much worse shape than it is. As you probably realize, America still is in a lot better shape than religiously than most countries in the world. We have approximately 50% of our population that's church members, which means something like 110 million people in America belong to church roles. More than 25% of our people do attend church at least once a month, whereas in some of the countries, such as France, the percentage is down as low as 2 to 3%. So the Americans still have a vitality in religious matters. A large theological school abroad is 100 people. When you tell them that there are schools in Texas that have 600 and 1,500, 600 being Dallas Seminary, and Fort Worth Theological Seminary has 1,500 students in a theological school, people on the continent think that's a Texas joke. They cannot conceive of a school that large in theology. So the First Great Awakening takes place quite early in the colonial period. It is a tremendous moving at this period, I would say, of the Spirit of God bringing regeneration. And what has happened is there's been decline. Many of the Puritans and people who came over realized that America was becoming in a very desperate way spiritually. People came over for religious reasons, but when they got there, they settled down, they farmed the land, they became prosperous, and when they became prosperous, they decided, well, we've got it made now, and they began to turn God off. So they became materialistic, and so they became careless, and God raised up a couple of men to do a lot of preaching. The two men that are most famous at this point are Jonathan Edwards and William Tennant. The Tennants were Presbyterians, and Jonathan Edwards was a Congregationalist. And it's interesting that this Great Awakening that took place in the Presbyterian and the Calvinistic groups. It was a strong stress on preaching and a strong stress on evangelism. There were a lot of private prayer meetings, pastoral visitation, maintenance of strong discipline. It really was an awakening. However, it didn't really help satisfy everybody. It caused a number of splits. In the Presbyterians, you're going to have... We might just talk about Presbyterians for a moment in America. Presbyterians began migrating very early. The first Presbyterian church of Charleston, South Carolina, was an independent Presbyterian church. It was formed before the 1700s. It was formed about 1690. And it remained independent until it finally merged with the Southern Presbyterian Church. Organized Presbyterianism begins in around 1706. And you get a Presbyterian denomination which is going to split into the old side and new side. They did not agree on the revival. The Presbyterians, some of them didn't like revivalism, and they didn't like the idea that some of the new sides felt that people could be preaching who were not educated. And the old side said that man has to be... educated theologically before he can preach, but people in the revivals were getting saved and going out preaching, and so they split over these issues. They later on merged, but the same problem that they faced of tradition and enthusiasm later came to a head in a new split that they will have in the old school and new school. They're going to split in 1838 really over slavery, but there were same issues that were within Presbyterianism from the beginning. We could also point out that you're going to really get splits that will eventually grow into the Presbyterian Church in the north, and of course the Presbyterian Church in the south, which will become Presbyterian Church in the U.S., which is now, of course, as you know, split again. This group has just split. There has been a major split, and they have formed what is called now the National Presbyterian Church. The Orthodox have split off from the liberals in this group. So the Presbyterians were active in the Great Awakening and did quite a job of evangelism at this period. The Congregationalists also did, and they also split over the same issue. They split over old lights and new lights over the revival. Some of the clergy were for revivalism, some were not. George Whitefield is the famous figure at this time. He is his dates of preaching in America is really 1740. He is really one of the key men in revival in America. You ought to do some reading sometime on Whitefield. The southern colonies also had a great deal of emphasis in the Great Awakening. The Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Methodists, all began to have awakenings at this point. And the results of the Great Awakening are somewhat staggering. Out of around 200,000 people in America at this time, it's estimated that at least 30,000 were added to the church out of 200,000. So you can see that although America was very small, that revival reached approximately at least 10-12% of the people were added to the church as the result of that one revival, which would be like if we had a revival in America today, and as a result of it, you would have approximately 20 million people added to the church. That was the magnitude of that movement. In that period, 150 new congregations were added. There was a tremendous increase in students to prepare for the ministry, an increase of new schools, an increase of new denominations. The new denominations that arise at this time are the Baptist and the Methodist. The Baptists were in America at this time, but now they become really denominations. You get regular Baptists who go back to Roger Williams in the 1630s. They were a very small group. And then you get separate Baptists. They really separate out of the Congregationalists. And over splits and issues that arise in the revivals. They will really just flow together. They really do not become a denomination. In 1845, Baptists as a whole split again, and the issue again is going to be the Civil War, slavery issue. The Southern Baptists will form as a denomination right off. The Northern Baptists do not form as a denomination. We can look at it this way with the Northern Baptists. The Northern Baptists continue just as one of the features of a Baptist is the Baptist says he's not a denomination. He's an association. There was really not a Northern Baptist Association until 1908. And when they merged into an association, or went into an association, they were already liberal. They were really formed as a liberal denomination. This group, though, the Southern Baptists, began as a very conservative reaction, theologically and politically, etc., and they always were an association, and they have continued on to the present time. So the Baptists were formed at this period, and they will become a very, very powerful force in American church history for some reasons that we will spell out in a moment. The Methodists that come over, 1784 is the date that we would say for Methodism. The reason why we might just mention, we did not mention Methodism in Anglicanism because we didn't stay in English church history long enough. Methodism begins in England. It is a protest movement against the dying of the state church or the deadness of the Anglican church. The main men, of course, are Wesley and Whitefield. They both preach in England, and of course they both come to America. But Wesley's major emphasis is England, Whitefield's is America. Wesley is much more noted for his Arminianism. Whitefield was noted for his Calvinism. And so in England, they went two different directions. You had a Methodist, a Calvinistic Methodist church, the Whitefield branch in England. That did not really hold true in America. But Wesley was the great man here. He did a great deal of preaching, open field preaching. And in the year 1869, Wesley began to officially appoint men to come to America to carry on the work of revival. And the key man that is sent to America is a man named Francis Asbury. There's an Asbury College and an Asbury Seminary. And this man does a tremendous work of being a missionary to America. He is persecuted when he comes, but he does a lot of preaching, and the work of Methodism will spread rapidly. The things that cause the Methodists and the Baptists to spread is that it is a lay movement. The Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, the Anglicans, they have a sharp disjuncture between clergy and laity. And so it only spreads by an educated clergy. Presbyterians, Anglicans, Episcopalians, Congregationalists have always had a high view of the ministry, that it should be an intelligent, educated ministry. This has caused them always to be a slow-growing group. And when revivalism came, the Baptists, who were much looser organized and had the idea that anybody who was called could preach, they had many men go out and preach. And so the same way with the Methodists. They had many circuit preachers, circuit riders. And so these particular groups began to spread very rapidly. Another thing that we have not mentioned is America is beginning to be colonized inland. And as the people migrate inland, the looser structured groups like Baptists and Methodists can follow them, whereas the idea of having an educated man who has to go through college and seminary to go out takes a longer time. And so the Presbyterians and the Anglicans, they sort of lost ground here. The next man that is also important is a man named Coke, Thomas Coke, who is sent. Coke and Asbury are sent both by Wesley to America. And we have, as you know, in our town, a Cokesbury bookstore. That is, of course, named after these two great lights in Methodism. Asbury, they were both supposed to be joint superintendents in America. However, Asbury liked the sound of the word bishop, and so he considered himself bishop in America. Wesley didn't like it, but there wasn't much he could do about it, but we had American bishops from that point. And so in 1784, from that point on, you really have a Methodist church in America with a bishop. And this will continue until 1843, and you will have a split. A group, the Wesleyan Methodists, the more conservative group, will pull off, and then there will be a major split again in the Civil War period over the issue of slavery, and you get the Methodist Episcopal Church in the north, the Methodist Episcopal Church in the south. It's called Episcopal because that's the form of church government. They will unite in 1939. This group still has not united with them. It is still a separatist group, a smaller group. So you get the Methodists coming along in America. I think I have one other... it's the same, really, of the chart on the Presbyterian Church of the Great Awakening. I want to come down now to Christianity and the American Revolution. The religion, in a sense, played a very important part in the Revolution. Many of the people who were influential in government were afraid of the Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholics were fairly large, and that they were in Quebec, large numbers of Catholics there. Many people were afraid of Anglicanism being established in the nation. And so in the revolution that took place, people, as they reacted against the political tyranny, it's interesting to see how people lined up. The Congregationalists were the most active. They really took a strong stand in the revolution. They took a strong stand for religious liberty. And they felt that they wanted to get separate from England with all of its control. The Anglicans were the most loyal to the king, obviously. But it's an interesting fact that two-thirds of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were Anglicans. Now, the reason for that probably was is that they were the most moneyed in the land, and they tended to belong to the higher church, the Episcopal Church. The Quakers, they were pacifist. Very few were fighting Quakers. However, Betsy Ross, who made our American flag, was a Quaker. Presbyterians were the first religious body in America to accept the Declaration, and they as a body identified with the revolutionary cause. So you have a strong Presbyterian in favor of the revolution. The Baptists, many of them were persecuted very heavily in Rhode Island. They were loyal to the revolution. Many of them were very, very heavily persecuted during the period. The Methodists did very little in the revolution. They were tied to the Anglican Church, and as a whole, they were despised by the Americans because of Wesley. Wesley was opposed to the American Revolution, and he tried to stop the war, which made Methodism very unpopular for a while, and religion went on a serious decline for a number of years in the Methodist circles. The Catholics were noncommittal, but most sided with the colonialists. So what you had was as the result of the revolution, you're going to have Anglicanism is going to be disestablished. Since America is now separate from England, nobody wants the state church of England over them. And so the six colonies that had Anglican control, no longer is Anglicanism going to be the favored religion, and there's going to be a reaction against it. Congregationalism is going to be disestablished in New England. Once again, the Congregationalists, many of whom were loyal to the English Church in one sense as Puritans, now found that their favorite position was going to be disestablished because the majority of people did not want that tie. Then a next factor that happens is that many churches are going to decide to organize national churches. Since they're no longer tied to anything else, you have a new nation, you have new national churches. So you get the Protestant Episcopal Church, which replaces the Anglican Church. You get the Methodist Episcopal Church. You get the Roman Catholics organizing under John Carroll, who becomes the Archbishop, and then the Presbyterians organizing a General Assembly. Now, there were some negative aspects to the Revolution. Religion declined in those years because of attention to the war. War is never good for religion. There might be some pious prayers uttered, but usually churches are destroyed, men are away from home, families are torn up, gifted men are don't going through the ministry. And so there was a serious decline during the Revolutionary War. The reorganization process during the end of the war caused a serious decline in evangelism. And the Calvinism was in a serious decline. And the fact that most of American leaders were not orthodox religiously caused some serious problems. Men like Ben Franklin, that people looked up to. Now, Ben Franklin was a deist. In fact, you can read Ben Franklin's creed, in which he wrote a creed which really developed his own religion. He was a very novel type person. And you have coming into America at this time something that is going to very seriously affect American religious life, which is going to be deism and Unitarianism. A number of things are happening in the continent that's going to affect America. There is going to be changes in astronomy, changes in philosophy, changes in natural theology, in which people are going to think, well, God really doesn't intervene in history. It is all running, and the deist are beginning to infiltrate American life. And so you have a tremendous decline religiously at this period. And this will continue until Unitarianism spreads over a large part of America in the early part of the 1800s. So that is all I want to say under the first period of American history. The second period is the national period, and I just want to spend about 5 minutes on it. The second period, the national period, goes from 1789 to 1865. And here we will have the Second Great Awakening. And the need for the awakening is quite evident. The destruction of the war, the decline of naturalism, I mean, of the decline of the churches in America, the deism and the Unitarianism spreading. So what will happen is there will become a prayer meeting that starts at Yale College, in which Timothy Dwight and others begin praying. And at Yale, one-third of the students will be converted at this time in one awakening. Revivals will begin to occur from 1802 through 1820. A number of colleges such as Amherst, Dartmouth, Williams, Hampton Sydney, Washington College, all at this time began to experience a revival. And so, just like there was a Jesus movement that took place in America not too long ago among the youth, at the youth at this time, there was a tremendous movement of the Spirit of God in which a revival took place. In certain parts, the revival broke out in camp meetings, particularly in the western part of the Second Great Awakening. And here, the Methodists and the Baptists, hundreds and thousands of people were converted. Some strange things happened in these camp meetings, and some of the people were very much turned off by the movement. There were what was called the bodily excesses. There were people who would go into holy jerks and to fits and so on. It's almost like what you have today with the Pentecostal revivalism spreading across the land. So you have a mixed bag in all these awakenings. There's always controversy, and there's always some strange things that arise. As the result of the awakenings, you're going to have some new denominations arising. You're going to get the Cumberland Presbyterian Church in 1810. Because of the revivalisms that are going to take place, they're going to some of them are going to want a non-educated ministry, men who can who are filled with the Spirit, who can preach. And so the Cumberlands will they'll stress man being called more than a man being educated. They will also react against some of the harsh Calvinistic theology of the Presbyterians. And so the Cumberland Presbyterian Church comes into existence in the year 1810. The Disciples of Christ also arise out of Presbyterianism during the revivals. They call themselves simply Christians. Thomas and Alexander Campbell, a group of Presbyterians get together, disband Presbytery, and call themselves simply Christians or Disciples of Christ. And they, of course, grow into another denomination. So what you have is, out of the second revival, you get new denominations, you get new schools. Andover Seminary is founded in 1807 to counteract the liberalism of Harvard. Princeton Seminary is founded in 1812 to counteract liberalism. And Lane Seminary in 1821 is also founded to counteract liberalism. But all of them, as you know by today, have gone liberal. So there is a constant, you know, it seems like there's a growth and then there's a decline. The problem always is what do you do with the second generation? And many of you here probably face the same problem. You might put your trust in Jesus Christ and you love the Lord and you pray for your children. But then your children don't accept the Lord. And so the problem is always the problem of the second generation. How can a person guarantee that his children will be godly? Well, there's no way you can guarantee it. Now, you can pray for your children, and you can endeavor to try to lead them to Jesus Christ. But there is no way that you can say, if I do this, regeneration will be the result. And the history of America has proven over and over again that it's easy to start things, hard to keep them going, and keep them going in a religious way that is pleasing to the Lord. So I think we'll just stop at this point. Our time is over, and we'll stop here and close in prayer and then let you ask questions. Father, we want to thank you for the varied heritage that we have in America. We want to thank you that in spite of all of the failures and the accidents, seemingly, of history, that you have worked in our nation to produce something that has had a tremendous effect in the world in missions, that you have been pleased to use America religiously in many of the different ways. And we thank you, Father, for the fact that even now we enjoy many of the fruits of the men who came over and laid strong foundations in education and in the various groups that came over with their stress upon the Word of God. We thank you, Father, for our privilege of studying church history in this way, to understand something of the past so that we might be better equipped to live in the present. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, let's ask questions now. I realize I've thrown a lot of information at you, but I want you to sort of get a picture of what's happened and where we're at and why we got here. Well, the thing that was, I'd have to say two things. Wesley was an Arminian, committed. And Wesley was an organizational genius. Whitfield was a great evangelist, but he didn't have any administrative ideas. He felt that his ministry was simply evangelism, and the only thing that he really put his stress on was evangelism, and then an orphanage that he had a great concern on. He worked and raised funds constantly for this orphanage in Georgia. So those were his major concerns: evangelism in the organized churches. Wherever he would go and preach as an evangelist. But Wesley's concern was for organization, organizing Christians into small groups in Christian nurture. So when they passed off the scene, well, the organization was in the hands of basically the Wesleyan segment. And Wesley had the vision to send, he realized, he himself never separated from Anglicanism, but he realized after his death that his movement would have to separate. And so he ordained or laid hands on several men to be bishops. And so you got a firm ecclesiasticism through Wesley's genius for organization and nurture.